The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Well, here's the outline. We're going to have a little bit on the biography of Rudy Henry Wiebe, and then we're going to have a synopsis of the novel, and then some questions which we're going to talk about, and most of the questions you can answer just from the discussion which I present, so it won't be that impossible, I hope. Now, I'd like to begin by just telling you the angle from which I'm coming and just give you a few sort of preliminary keys to how we're going to see some of these things. Now, the first is, I'm going to take sort of my own stand here, that I see myself fundamentally as an evangelical, because I believe that's what Christianity is. But if you're not an evangelical, you're something else. And you might be a Christian and not being an evangelical, but it'd be because you're a confused evangelical. Now, I take the definition of an evangelical from B.B. Warfield. It's a man who believes that God acts directly on the human heart in saving him without intermediary. He is not a sacerdotalist. He does not believe that God saves through the sacraments, that they are means of grace, but the sacraments are not, as it were, the means of salvation. That must be the word being applied directly to the heart by the Spirit. And so an evangelical, then, is one who believes that. Now, I'm also not an evangelical in general, but I am a Calvinistic evangelical, in that I believe that also the heart of that is that God sovereignly works in the heart. And that's what would distinguish my own approach from that of the semi-Arminianism, which is very popular today. But nonetheless, I have that in common with them, and I hope you do too, that you believe that God acts directly on the human heart in a saving way. And I think it's a mistake not to recognize that identity, which all evangelicals have in common. They believe in the new birth, and hopefully they have experienced it themselves. So I would say that, and I would also say that in the Spirit's outpouring in history, this is what is one of his main works. This is one of his main endeavors, to work in the heart, and one of the evidences of that work in the heart is the appearance in history of people who are Bible readers, people who love the Bible. They love the Bible more than they love the outward rituals. They love the Word of God. Okay? Now, third point I want to make, closely related to that, is that not long after God comes and begins operating directly on the human heart, there are powerful counter forces launched by the devil himself, and these come in the form of getting men to put something between God and themselves. It can be almost anything. I suppose in some cases it might almost be the Bible, which is the strangest thing you can imagine, but it could be a confession. It could be the Bible just as so much print, or it could be an icon, statue, a priest, a saint, a friend, a pastor, whoever it might be. But that tendency is the great counter-tendency in culture, and that almost any tradition, after it's had time to exist for a while, falls into that pattern. And so what you then have is a man may say all the right things, but it's a whole matter of what's in the foreground of his consciousness. And if you apply that to creeds, you know, here I am, I said I'm a Calvinistic evangelical, it'd be very easy for me, as I'm devoted to the Westminster Confession, to let the Westminster Confession become a screen between me and the Bible, or between me and Christ, because I have such great respect for it. And so it's a question of what's in the foreground. I never have a right to put anything in the foreground of my consciousness except God and God's Word and God's Christ. Nothing else has a right to that kind of priority. And even grand and glorious secondary standards must be secondary. And that's what keeps me from falling away, from being an evangelical, from having that hardening of heart, that apostasy, which constantly comes into the church. So what basically I'm saying then is this. The church history is the story of trends and counter-trends, of movement and counter-movement, of the Spirit breaking in, reviving, bringing life, and then the processes of death and decay setting in. And you get that in the New Testament. Here you have this grand and glorious book, addressed, that circular letter, which has the title Ephesians on it. Now, it probably was addressed to a wider group than just the Ephesians, but it was to that area, and so it went to the church at Ephesus, and a grand picture of the church is given to you there, right? But then you open Revelation chapter 2, and what do you learn about this grand church? It's already slipping deeply into dead orthodoxism. And that's the story. And so often, one generation of people comes along and God works in their lives, they read the Bible, their hearts are humbled, broken before God, they're filled with praise and good works, and their children or their grandchildren have really forgotten all these things. But even sometimes in their own generation, an evangelical can become a non-evangelical. Now, you say, I mean, unsaved, saved. I don't really try to figure out all things. Was Solomon saved and lost? I don't know all of that. But I do know there comes in an awful hardening of heart very quickly to all of us. And so these are great forces, the conflict between Christ and Satan in history, taking this concrete form. Now, we can make it even more particular and bring it down to what may be the most important thing that you can know about in ministry. And it's the tendency within the body of Christ to take outward things, maybe outward, traditions of any kind, and let them begin to freeze up and be confused with the gospel itself. If your national background, the Volkskirche, the People's Church, if you look in the back of that excellent book I referred to by Edmund S. Morgan, The Puritan Family, he's got a chapter on tribalism. And he's talking about New England, why their strong faith there just went to froze up. Well, the answer is that this tribalism is inherent in the apostasy of the heart when we become what I call non-evangelicals. And it can take any form. Here's the village church. And after a while, you're there, and the village church develops a kind of a community role, which may be desirable because you want to identify with the community. Fine. But pretty soon that village church has become a social institution, and Jesus Christ and culture have been identified. The church is the place where you go to marry, where you go to bury, and baptize, and to get the stamp of Christ's approval on culture. And Jesus Christ is being acculturated more and more. And the minister is defined as one who performs certain services. He baptizes, he marries, and he buries in order to, as it were, keep unity in this society. He keeps the world from being disturbed. And so you get the image of the nice pastor. He's the priest. And if the people in that community are a little more narrow and they have a certain ethnic background, it becomes even more intensified. And so that Jesus Christ is identified with the Germans. Christ is German. Or Christ is Dutch. Or Christ is Scots. Or Christ is Irish. Republican Irish. Or Ulster Irish. And you may laugh, but you may die from it someday. Here's the material for your martyrdom. Why do you think Caiaphas called for the death of Jesus? He might destroy the tribe. He might destroy the people, the tradition. You remember the passage that I'm talking about? You know nothing. Let's look at it just for a moment. Let's see, John, that would bring us to chapter 11, verse 49. He wasn't exactly impressed by the opinions and insight of his contemporaries. I'd like to have him for a teacher. But a certain one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all." It's a great opening remark to conciliate your audience. You better be pretty sure what you're going to say. And having opened with that statement, he says, "Nor do you take into account," and this is the issue, "that it is necessary for you that one man should die for the people and that the whole nation should not perish." Now, he was actually making a prophecy here, a beautiful statement from the point of view of the gospel, but from his own point of view, what he meant was culture, salvation, that the people must live. Israel, what? Israel, high. Not Yahweh high, not Adonai high, but Israel must live. And so Israel must live because Israel is important. Israel's God. Not let God live, but let Israel live. Let the tribe live. Let the family live. Let the little congregation live. Never disturb it. It has its traditions. The traditions are more important than God. And I think you now have seen something that's very profound in culture. I just say this by way of relationship to Donald McGavran. I'm very appreciative, deeply appreciative of the insights he has to offer in church growth. But I think it needs added to it some caution in the one respect that if you work through people movements, you must be working with realizing some of the dangers I'm talking about for background. Because people very quickly turn their churches into Volkskirches. And when you do that, I'll tell you the truth, you're willing to kill to preserve it. You're willing to slander, you're willing to excommunicate, you're willing to do almost anything. Depending on the form in which your people's church has gone, and it becomes a very deadly thing. Okay. Now to Rudy Henry Wiebe, spelled W-I-E-B-E, "Peace Shall Destroy Many." The book came out in 1962, and he has two other books. The second book was in 1966. It's called The First and Vital Candle. The First and Vital Candle. And then the third book came in 1970, The Blue Mountains of China. The Blue Mountains of China. As to his biography, and that's our first point, he writes about things of which he has experienced. His Mennonite parents came to Canada from Russia in the year 1930. Rudy was born 4 years later in a one-room log cabin in Saskatchewan. And, of course, this is the area of Canada where the story is set. The family moved from there to Coaldale, Alberta, in 1947, and Wiebe was encouraged to write in a high school, a Mennonite high school there. It was called the Alberta Mennonite High School. From there, he went on to the University of Alberta, and then he taught at Goshen College in Indiana, and at present he's at the University of Alberta, assistant professor of English, at least at the time that my fax came into being. Now, the book itself, the synopsis, goes like this. Now, this is a rough outline. It misses many salient things. In 1944, the small pacifist Mennonite community of Wapiti in the Canadian bush faces a world at war. Under the leadership of Deacon Peter Block, the community seeks to preserve itself by a policy of self-conscious isolation. Now, tribalism can go the other way. If it's a majority tribalism, it can simply try to identify completely with the majority. But if it's a minority, it can go the other way, simply by way of isolation. Here it is moving by way of isolation, and the isolation includes several ways, several forms. It's spatial isolation, that they've deliberately gone way up there in the bush. Now, they needed to go up there because they were poor, but also they had a motive that Block led them up there to keep them away from other people. They also practice economic isolation, that is, they buy out the Indians and the half-breeds to get them out of the way. You might call that racial or social isolation also that is involved. There's also language isolation in that these people who come from Russia, they speak Russian, most of them, but they also speak high and low German. And English is a language they don't push very much. They try to keep that out. And they have a few people who've learned it, and all the young people can speak it, of course. But the real language is German. Then there's also moral isolation. They have their own Mennonite school, and they have a moral isolation too, in the particular Mennonite discipline, the discipline of love. I'm sure that there's so much here we could learn from the Mennonites. I think we should be careful in a book which is almost fiercely critical of something which happened in one of the communities that we not forget that God did teach the Mennonites some things. And one of the things is a close-up practice of love, as well as admonition when you don't live up to it. So this discipline of love and also hard work, all of this distinguishes them from the so-called heathen. Then also there's religious isolation. There is a separate German church. And in this church, everything must be held. All the services are to be held in the German language. Now, you may think nothing like this ever happened in the United States or in Canada, but it has happened in this language and any number of other languages. And it might be a little alarming for you to learn that one of the reasons the pilgrims came to this country is they didn't want their children in Holland learning Dutch or forgetting English. So none of us are all that immune from these things. Then the whole picture then is of a church with many walls drawn around it. And basically what you can say is the world is kept out by social discipline. The world is excommunicated. And of course the question comes up, you suddenly discover the church is now the world, but we'll hold that one back for a moment. By his genius, Block, this deacon, has intensified and deepened the traditional union of Mennonite German culture and Christianity in order to provide a safe, clean world for his son. Now, that's a very worldly interest, isn't it? An inherently violent man, he uses the Mennonite pacifist principle to preserve the unity of the community. This principle is challenged by Joseph Duke, and so it's Duke versus Block at the beginning. Joseph Duke is the school teacher. He begins a Bible class in English for half-breed children, holds a young people's meeting outdoors, and sees some visitors from the outside standing there, and he switches over to English. And he's called on the carpet in a church meeting, and he directly challenges the German Mennonite exclusivism. And this is sort of a horrifying thing to do, and you get the picture in the meeting that these two very large men, one is Joseph and the other is Peter Block, really looking thunder and lightning at one another, and it's a very tense time. And the young man, Tom, Tom Weens, stands in the middle, and he's also a very large young man, and as many Germans are. So Joseph leaves and goes to the medical corps. Remember the Second World War, 1944. Joseph Duk goes to the medical corps. He's not going to be taking part in active fighting. And he leaves Tom as the protagonist, to Block. And the young man takes over Joseph's Bible class, and he has somewhat of the secret blessing of the pastor left, but it's not going to be very much out in the open because he feels he's got to go along with the tradition as exemplified by Deacon Block. Now, this comes to a cracking when ethnic culture, ethnic Christianity, begins to break down when unmarried Elizabeth Block, that's Peter Block's daughter, dies in childbirth, and Block conceals the cause of the death. He's a man of iron will, titanic strength, and he runs the community not just simply by cruelty, not at all. He's every man's friend, every man's support, every man's wisdom. He's there to help you. If you have a need, he's there. And in essence, he is the true pastor for the community. And so this is a terrible thing, and he conceals it. And this, of course, has a real problem. It means that he's got two things now on his conscience. Back in Russia, he committed murder. Now, this is what makes this so ironic. I don't know whether all these things happen, but in the 1920s, 22, when food was really short, Block killed one of the robbers. But he killed the robber after he was taken captive. And even on, you know, the greatest stretching of any principle, that is murder, killing a man who is a prisoner. Now, he did that in order to really make life safe for his son, and he seems to have experienced some kind of repentance for it. But in coming to Canada, he's built everything to make this world safe for his family. Now, you see, here's the essence of tribalism. It comes right down finally to my little tribe, my own personal clan. I'm going to make the world safe for my clan, and I'm going to make my family the best of that you can. And so then when she dies, Elizabeth dies, this is a beginning of a cracking of the whole thing. And the next thing that happens is that with Joseph gone, they need a new teacher, and a worldly teacher arrives, Miss Razia Tantamont. And she becomes the key to understanding what happens next. She becomes a revelation of many people's sin, and she stirs up the young men. She's seductive and definitely a loose woman and a gifted one. All right, another crisis comes out in that they begin to ask, Peter Block Jr. asks Tom, what are you going to do with these half-breeds that you're teaching? They're beginning to get more and more interest in the Bible. Families are beginning to listen in, not only the children. What are your plans? And he says, well, no problem. He says, we're going to make them Christians. And that is the horrifying thought. And Block, son and father, say they're not the right stuff. They're not good German Mennonites. And you can't make Christians out of people who don't have it together. And so the you can see the theology here is lacking good deal, but this is what you get. Once you get tribalism, and it may be not heavily sacerdotal or ritualistic, but it inevitably involves some kind of power in culture. And here the power is the right to exclude. And once the young man announces that he's going to bring them to the church, you see, there's war. And the crisis then is over the half-breeds, with Tom wanting them to become Christians, and Block moves in rapidly and buys them out and excludes them from the community by buying their land. He's a wealthy man, or at least a man of considerable means, and so he buys them out and excludes them from the community. He has another reason. One of them, Louis, is the one who has made his daughter pregnant. Well, the plot thickens, that Block gets more and more revelations of what he's really like, in that when he, at this point, comes to a final split with Tom, the young man, Tom Weems. And this final split takes the form of Tom telling him that he knows his secret about Elizabeth. He knows she was pregnant, illegitimate child, and the child had died in childbirth, and she died with it. And he does it in a fit of anger. And, of course, you see the sin now of Tom beginning to come out. So you can see this is proceeding along very interesting lines, very Calvinistic, in that total depravity is beginning to be manifested. Now, I don't mean that the way some of you may think. I mean, rather, here is a clear insight of wisdom. He's not dividing the novel into sort of white hats and black hats. He's showing you that there's sin both ways. That there's no man without sin. And I think that makes it so distinctively a Christian novel. Now, you can show that without having a Christian novel, but a Christian novel certainly must have that. So you have the revelation here, not only of Block's sin, but of Tom's. And, of course, you see Block is a man apparently utterly without feelings, because his main concern for his daughter is that, well, he's worried she might be in hell, but he feels no remorse over the fact that he had a part in it. He wouldn't let her marry a Herb Unger, sort of a dissolute Mennonite type. Apparently there were those, a few of those around too. And so she was kept back from marriage by the father. Well, as this plot thickens and it gets, things become more and more out in the open, the climax comes over a Christmas program put on by Razia Tantamount. This Christmas program, she does it up brown. She knows the Mennonites are all religious, so she does it really. She gets all the stuff together, and it's really an outstanding program. And they're all impressed, and they've taken up an offering for her. And when they call her forward, receive the offering, she's not there. Instead, she's out in the barn with Hank Unger, who is shot down 27 German planes. And you get sort of two things now in the Mennonite culture. You have, on the one hand, the extreme position of nonviolence taken by Block, supposedly nonviolence. On the other hand, you get a rebel like Hank Unger, who apparently has just lived to shoot down German planes. So you get these two, and so here she is out there in the barn. Well, when you get out to the barn, Pete Block Jr., who was sincerely in love with her, sees them there, and he knocks Hank Unger down. Now, the appropriate moral is coming in just a moment. And Herb Unger shows up too, who's the dissolute Unger, and he is also, he comes out of the stream of obscenities and Tom, and he's ready to hit Pete Block Jr., and Tom is standing there, and he is a very large, strong man, probably stronger than any of the rest, except maybe for Block. He spins him around, and he knocks him cold. So the moral being drawn at that point by the worldling is this. She, her crumbled dress, face abandoned, etc. And Block is asking, what went on here? You're too late for this show. And the laughter flared through again, and then between gasps, Pete found things not quite Mennonite. You hadn't told him what to do, so he smashed Hank. And then Tom smashed Herb. All these loving Mennonites smashing. And so this was her summary of the book. And that's exactly what's happening. All these lovely Mennonites are smashing one another. And the anger is boiling up. You might say, well, wow, that proves that the worldling is right. No, it doesn't. It rather proves that they are all coming to a revelation of sin, which shows that sin is something so powerful and so deep in a man that unless there's something very special to deal with it, there isn't any hope. And so you go back a few pages, and here is Tom, who is really the idealist. He's the one who's decent, and he's not like Block. He and Joseph are wonderful people, and they're not like Hank or Herb or any of the rest. But what he discovers as he watches Herb Unger, the animalism of Herb Unger, and the violence of Hank Unger, he notices this, and this is the revelation of himself to himself. The body, the body, the body. It was impossible to think of Anna Maria in that way, but Razia, this is Tom. Abruptly, he found that if he allowed his mind a corner of leeway, he could think in unison with Herb. The realization staggered him. His mind, strange to such thoughts, went fumbling after the tantalizing figure in the tight green dress. Such wells of depravity yawned in his empty self that he could only shudder and pray for diversion. So you see, here it is. He sees himself as he is. Now, at this point, Block is brought also to the revelation of himself, in that when he discovers the whole Mennonite community blown apart here, the deacon bowed his scarred gray head to his hands, and the men of Wapiti community, Metis and Mennonites, standing in an old barn, heard the sobs of a great strong man. Suddenly bereft and broken, they heard, terrified. Pretty powerful ending. Now, the interesting thing is this, that on the very last page, the father of Tom, you said, I believe this is the father. No, this is really Tom himself. The evening overwhelmingly upon him, it would be long before he could conceive of how much had been sloughed aside that night in Wapiti. And then he says this. Now listen to this. Here's a summary of the book. Then Jackie LeBray, bending down to lead the way to the manger, stood before him. There must lie the way. So they've got this scene in front of them there. Not the paths of conscienceless violence or one man's misguided interpretation of tradition. They brought chaos, but the path of God's revelation. Christ's teachings stood clear in the scriptures. Could he but scrape them bare of all their acquired meanings and see them as those first disciples had done, their feet in the dust of Galilee, he must. And as seeing Jackie again, a long forgotten statement by Joseph rose to his memory. We are spared war duty and possible death on the battlefield only because we are to be so much the better witnesses for Christ here at home. Comprehending suddenly a shade of those words' depths, he realized that two wars did not confront him, only one's own two faces, and he was felled before both. No, if in suppression avoidance lay defeat, then victory beckoned in pushing ahead. Only a conquest by love unites the combatants, and in the heat of this battle lay God's peace. My peace I give unto you, not as the world giveth. Weens was praying, God have mercy on me, a sinner, in silence. Now he drives out, and it looks, as the author says, as if he were following a star as he drives away. But you get the picture of a cry here at the end for grace. Now, you're not told all that much about what grace he receives, but that's where it ends. Pretty powerful book. Pretty powerful book. I think the mildly depressing side of it is that he doesn't seem to be clear enough in the teaching, either the church or all the rest, of the forgiveness of sins through the imputation of Christ's righteousness, and that really sins are freely forgiven on that basis. And the confession is great, you know, is objectively based upon that standard of God's work in Christ and God's justice being satisfied in Jesus' death. There is that wonderful fellowship which we have growing out of that. And then, of course, there seems to be also in the book the understanding, a lack of understanding of the presence of God personally working in the heart with grace, the work of the Holy Spirit close up. It seems to be quite evident. It's missing. But having those two reservations, the book is still pretty distinctively Christian, and it is in this way that the answer comes back to what I said at the very beginning of the class, that the clash between a deadening traditionalism and a dead orthodoxism focuses on getting back to the Bible. That the true evangelical is the Bible reader, the one who wants to get through to the Word and let the Word get through to him without even putting on it his own acquired interpretations of it. The man who reads the Bible every day as though he had never read it before. You see, once you begin to read the Bible the same way you read it yesterday, you're already headed down the road of dead orthodoxism. And we must fight it every day. It's the devil's own strategy for taking truth and turning it into a cliché, into a truism. If he can do that, you see, he can lull you right down the road he wants, and you never know that you've gone that road. And you could end up persecuting then those who are God's own sons and not realize it. One of the young men who was converted in this seminary told me this, and he said, in my church background, and he came from a church background which was very much an ethnic one, he said, I used to persecute people that seemed to me to be super spiritual. Now, he says, it dawned on me after my conversion here at Westminster that I was persecuting the Christians in the church. And he says, that's the most awful thought to hit me in a long time. You see, this is the battle, and here it is. So he grasped the heart of the matter, maybe not as clearly as I would like, but certainly as a writer, he did much better than I would ever do. So I'm deeply appreciative of that. That's kind of the synopsis then. And we now can go over to the area of some questions. And of course, I've probably made them too hard for anybody, whether you had read the book or not. But basically, I'd like to start off by a question about why is it that Block or any parent has such great fear of losing a son? Why is that such a great fear? Why is that so strong in us? You have any thoughts on that? Why is this so important that we not lose a son? Now, we have in it some obvious answers. One would be natural affection and so on. But why does a man want a son? What's involved in a son? Tom?
Maybe, at least for Block, the hope of a realization of things that he had never had for himself, or that's the one point at which a man can, where he leaves off, and in case of what you said about Block, maybe his own failures, maybe his own bad conscience about these things that he left in Russia, or things that hope to set his son away from, to assure his son that he will be, so extension of himself.
Okay, you put it all together. It's sort of an extension of himself. That's pretty important, isn't it? Yes.
Okay,
Yeah, these two go together, don't they? It's his only immortality. And so what you get is a really an ironic thing here. The man who is the leader in the religious community, who really swears by the Bible, has no awareness of himself as going to, as having eternal life, or his son having that. And the only way he can get permanence is by something being fixed in this world. Now, do you see why that makes it desperately important for him to create a fixed order? It's why the Englishman must have his tea, even though he's in the jungle, you know, and it's 110 and the humidity's 100 or 98, and he still boils tea, you know. And it's why? Well, it's his fixed order. It gives him security. And so Captain McQueer the book Typhoon, I think I used this illustration last week about how the typhoon has just knocked the ship to pieces practically, and he's really confused and he's ready to let the whole thing go down, and in the darkness he puts out his hand to steady himself, and he finds that familiar towel, and because that familiar towel, it's in place, he's reassured, and like a heroic Englishman should, he goes back to the battle and saves the ship. All because a towel was where it should be. Well, now you may laugh at that, but I think we could pick up this desire to have some kind of immortality in this world, and where it comes the strongest form in a son, that you can just, if you begin to think about it, you'll begin to observe all kinds of illustrations about it, of it. For instance, a few years ago, my wife and I, we visited the Cockney world in London. There is such a world, and there... very small, little people. And they are very interesting, very alive and alert and so on. They look, you think they're younger than they are. They're not, but they are older than they look. Anyway, what struck us was that when we were there the first time, they were pretty rough looking. We came back the second time a year or two later, and they had only been under Christian influence. These were not converts. But they all looked very polished. And I asked Miss Brand about that. I said, how do you account for... I asked them, these are all Christians, I said. No, she says, there are not any Christians out there at the moment. I said, well, how do you account for the fact their shoes are all polished, their hair is short, and so on? And so she said, well, you go out and ask them. So I went around and I asked them, how come you're all polished up here? And it turned out that after about 10 years old, nobody worries about you whether you take a bath or not. But these people all obviously bathed. And it was the moral response to the gospel. They hadn't believed, but they had been there even only a few weeks, and they began to clean themselves up outwardly, possibly as a substitute for an inner cleansing. So I guess the point would be, they say, strike a Russian and underneath you find a Tartar. Strike an Englishman, and underneath somewhere you find gentlemen and shoe polish or something, I don't know. But you have many, many nationalities. You'd be surprised how strong that sense of order is there. Now, some nationalities have had it pretty well squashed out of them, but it doesn't take them long. You'd be surprised how quickly they'll become critical of others who don't have their sense of order. And you'll be surprised how many black people are prejudiced against other blacks because those other blacks are less orderly than they. Have you ever noticed that? It's amazing. I sometimes wonder if there isn't more racial prejudice within some national groups over such issues. And of course, it becomes very crucial in respect to the family, because here's where pride is at its most intense. It's where you're putting your hope for immortality, and that's why people are more ready kill than you might imagine. In fact, they may even kill the son when he doesn't live up to the standards of what's expected. That can happen too. It sounds like it is an ironic twist, but it's there. All right, now the parent's fear then is that he might lose the son and therefore his immortality. And the other thing, of course, is that he's afraid of the loss of tradition, the moral order, even perhaps the loss of race. You get the impression in the book that he's he thinks pretty highly of the German race. He doesn't want to agree with Hitler or any of the rest, but nonetheless, the Germans are made of the right stuff. You can work with them. And that, again, that racism is there. All right, now let me ask, put a second question to you. Does it surprise you that the moral man will murder to preserve his moral values? Do you ordinarily expect that? Religious wars have been the worst. And wars where there's a moral issue are the ones where the worst slaughter takes place. Right. In the Middle Ages, people weren't always all that moral, and the Christian church spent a great deal of time taming these people. We kind of feel superior to the black nations in Africa, the way the tribes go at one another, and it's really going to be bad. Wayla Rhodesia gets its independence. You haven't seen anything. But we kind of smile, but man, you should have seen those German tribes hacking up one another. You know, favorite trick was to, you know, cut your enemy's head off and take that head home and clean it up and use it for a drinking cup. You know, I mean, that's pretty gross, you know. And some of you look blonde enough that probably were your ancestors involved in this kind of thing. And so that kind of thing then is behind all of us. But once that, what the church did was try to civilize these people in the Middle Ages, and they put various restraints on the wars. And after a while, it got so that war became a reasonably decent occupation, that you couldn't fight on the Lord's Day, the Sabbath day. They saw that. You couldn't fight on a saint's day. And they got it down, trimmed down to only about half the year could you fight, and you had to put your arms down. You get excommunicated, and you really were in trouble. And so they cut down the fighting time to at least half. So it was sort of the, you know, medieval way of doing football, making it more civilized. But then in the modern age, where men became more moral, and they are more moral in the 20th century, isn't it interesting that we have had the greatest cruelties of man to man as man has become more moralistic? 20th century man is very immoral moral. Hitler is a moral crusader liberating the Germans from the plague of the Jews and the Poles and all the rest. The communists, they're the most moral people in the world. Do you think, for instance, German armies in the Second World War had a crime record like American armies? You're much safer being occupied by German army than American army. You'd better watch out for your house and your wife. American army passes through. German army, if you at least don't get, you know, in opposition to them, you're safe. And so moral people, Eichmann, you know, taking care of his family, middle class style, and wiping out Jews at the same time. So the incredible irony of moral men killing more and more people. And of course, the civil wars of the century and the last bear that out too. So, but you don't see the strength of that until you realize that those men who put Jesus to death thought they were doing it for moral reasons. That's where it really came to its climax. Why did they kill him? Caiaphas says that it's got to be done because this man is going to destroy the tradition of the nation. And therefore, it's a moral thing. We're really doing a noble thing. So now when you go to Northern Ireland, as we did a little over a year ago, and we arrive there, I tell my wife and family, this fighting here has been exaggerated. You know how the newspapers are. We step out of the train. We've come up from Dublin, and one of these people who's always got every situation in control until he gets there. So we arrive, and I got my plan laid out. We're going to call Mr. Greer, and he'll come down and get us. And so we'll polish up a bit in the bathroom, to maybe have lunch while we're waiting and so on. All, everything's under control. Except when you step out in the train station, not only that, you look up and you can see sky in the train station. And you look for the bathroom, and there ain't no bathroom because it got blown up the way the roof got blown up. And so, and you begin to find out this is a world where these men are very moral and they mean it. And they're plenty mean. You see what's happened, that Christ and culture got identified. They reduced Christ to a moral principle, maybe a freedom principle. And everybody's killing the other person so everybody can be free. And if we keep on doing that, you see, there won't be anybody left to be free. And this is the way of the world. And so this moral intensity, if you want to read a brilliant non-Christian analysis of this, you might get a little booklet by Michael Polanyi, Polanyi. You know, he's the one who wrote Personal Knowledge, and it's put out by Oxford Press. It may be out of print by now, but I have a copy of it if you want to borrow it. Don't count on finding it in the library here, I doubt if they... The books I read in the library, they never seem to get together. But anyway, the thing is that is really true. All right, now the next thing... Oh, I'm sorry, Beyond Nihilism. Michael Polanyi. It's one of the most important things I think you could read for understanding this century. It's really profound. All right, now, let's go back to the book itself. I read you that section where Tom discovered that there was lust in himself that was very powerful. What is the Christian answer to that? The book didn't make that all that clear. What does a man do, or a woman, or anyone, when he discovers a world, there's a world of lust inside of him? Obviously, the moral tradition isn't going to help. That is, you may tighten down the lid and get better clamps on the top, but if the pot's boiling, what are you going to do? Jimmy Carter acknowledged what Tom discovered. It was a tremendous revelation to him. Now, what is a person going to do? Yes.
I think one of the things not to do is to concentrate on it, because that just seems to intensify it all the more. You just get wrapped up in the lust itself, it just gets bigger and bigger.
Right, the person may even try to confess it. And as the experience of finding as he confesses it, it brings back the whole memory of the thing. So he finds that he's against a power which is much bigger than himself. Well, now, the Englishman, the moral Englishman of the Conrad sort, which is the time I was referring to, Captain McQueer, he says, forget about it and pretend it isn't there. Sail into the heart of darkness, but don't look inside too much. Just, as it were, well, the Buddhists have the same answer. The less meaning or the more chaos there is on the inside, the more you maintain good outer form. That is, if it may be your secret inclination to just be a whoremonger filled with lust. But what you do, you make yourself into a gentleman. The exact opposite. Well, I know that the answer has got to be found in Christ. And I think it has to go back to this point. See, the man who is trying to get control of himself is trying to do it by his own will. Now, the problem is that you see, what Bloch was always doing, and what Tom was probably doing to this point, was saying the darkness is out there. Tom is over here. He sees the darkness out there, and he says, say, I've seen something new. Block is part of the darkness. Right? Revelation number one. Revelation number two, I'm part of the darkness. Now, he could easily forget that and suppress that second discovery and then try to overcome it by willpower. But, of course, the very nature of grace is that the sinner abandons his own will. And he does it in two ways. One, he recognizes that that guilt, which is so convicting, can only be paid for by another. And secondly, he recognizes that that guilt can only be, and the power of that sin, can only be changed by a new heart. And so he recognized that from Christ he must have two things, or three, the power of the Spirit also, along with the other two, the presence of the Spirit. And so Christ, if you don't know about this, I have a little booklet, or we have a little booklet called the New Life Booklet. We say man has three things wrong with him, bad record. Somebody finish it for me. Bad heart. All right. Bad master. And he needs, of course, a perfect record substituted for him. He needs a new heart grafted into him, a good heart, a clean heart. Ezekiel 36. And he needs a new power ruling over his life. Christ is a new master. Now, through faith, Christ becomes all of those. And so, what it is then, that the nature of the case, faith, is an abandonment of all of these, of any effort to establish your own righteousness. Not only are you convicted of sin, but you're convicted of the sin of self-righteousness. The righteousness which you try to achieve by your own will, your own effort. And then also the effort to clean up oneself inwardly, that is also self-will and self-effort, and simply dirties the man more, even though he may become very religious, he may become ascetic, or whatever it may be. And the same thing with to man is his master. Again, his own will is still his master, and he has no power to change himself. So the very heart of this change, then, lies in an abandonment of the will of man for the will of God. Now, just let me give you some comfort and counsel tonight. If you came here tonight with some tensions, you know, you brought them before I even generated more by telling you this story, okay? Well, what a beautiful thing it is. You have the answer.